This is XTP Media.
This episode is supported by Grub Street Publishing, publishers of the highly acclaimed Boys series, including the Victor, Valiant, Vulcan, Buccaneer, and Jaguar, and of course, soon to be published, the Harrier Boys. Publishers of over 100 military aviation books stretching from World War I to the present day. Find Grub Street Publishing at grubstreet.co.uk. And stay listening right to the end of this episode for the chance to win a signed copy of their latest published book.
You're listening to Extended. Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 42 of Extended, Europe's premier aerospace radio station. And today I'm flying solo in the studio whilst my colleagues Tim Robinson is on press week and preparing for Paris as we record this. Our executive editor at Global Aviation Resource, Gareth Stringer, is currently trying to balance at least three air shows he's working on. So good luck to those guys. With summer upon us here in the Northern Hemisphere, and of course those cold nights closing in down under, with so many great books on aviation and aerospace out at the moment, we thought we'd like to do a special feature to look at some of the great books around. So in today's feature, we have an interview with Rod Dean, former RAF squadron leader and Farnborough Airshow director, on his new book, 50 Years of Flying Fun. We also talked to Dr. Ron Smith about his recent booklet on Westland manufacturing aircraft at Yeovil over the past 100 years, as well as his new book, D.H. Moffs, De Havilland Moffs, a family album. We also get his views on his previous books as well on general aviation and aviation history. If that's not enough, we get introduced to aviationbookreviews.com by website founder and aviation book reviewer René Vergin, and talk about some of the hundreds of aviation books with reviews on the website. So looking forward to that. We're also going to have a look at a few books that we've been reading recently, and we wrap up with the top 10 summer reading recommendations from the Aviation Enthusiasts Book Club. So let's get on and start with our first interview, and that's with Rod Dean, the former RAF squadron leader, about his new book, 50 Years of Flying Fun. Rod, welcome to Extended.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much for taking some time out of your busy day. I know you're off to do some work on the other side of your career, which still seems to me to continue to burgeon. But we're here to talk about your latest book, and that's 50 Years of Flying Fun.
Yes.
It's a fabulous book. I'm absolutely enjoying it. What made you write these collection of stories?
Well, firstly, I'm glad to hear you're enjoying it. I mean, that's nice to hear somebody's somebody's actually read it and actually enjoying it, which is great.
It's great fun, honestly. Really learning a bit about the hunter I never knew, but you've found a style that balances that sort of technical. There's a bit of interest that, oh, I never knew that about that aircraft or that airfield, with some fabulous stories.
Well, yeah, and as I say, it's all been fun, or the vast majority of it has been fun. But I first started it because I've written a fair number of articles for magazines over the years, mainly of a technical nature about aircraft I've flown and things like that, and display flying. And I wanted to, really for my kids and grandchildren, really wanted to put down a record of what I had done over the years. And it was intended purely for internal consumption as much as anything else.
Right.
But then John Davis from Grub Street heard me talking at a lecture one evening and asked me would I like to consider writing a book, and I showed him the stuff I'd done, and he was kind enough to say he'd like to publish it.
Well, it's not a small book, Rod. 200 pages plus.
Yeah.
That's a lot of stories to have had filed away, sneaked away, and how did you manage to pull all those together? I mean, did you have a record of some of these things, or have you just got an amazing memory?
Well, and like all pilots, we keep logbooks. And so you go back and look through your logbook, and something triggers in the memory and says, "Oh yeah, I remember that." Yeah,
yeah.
And then it flows from there. And my wife always questions how I remember all these things, and I don't know how I remember them. It just springs to mind. But I do put a caveat at the front of the book that this is based on my memory, so some of it might well be flawed.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of detail, as I said, in there, which no doubt isn't flawed. Let's talk a little bit about your career then, and particularly flying the Hunter, which features an awful lot. It's a beautiful aircraft. I love it to bits. And seeing it display in the air shows at the moment, she's such a graceful bird. But where did your flying career start?
I went straight into the Air Force from school at 18 and got a direct entry commission and learned to fly straight from school and straight onto the Jet Provost. So in the early 60s, the Air Force was putting people straight in on jets without any previous training at all, which was fun.
Yeah, and then, as I mentioned, you went on to fly the Hunter in all its various guises and in various roles as well, everything from OCU instructor to operational flying. Tell me, which was your favourite model? You mentioned the F6 a couple of times as being one you liked. Was that your favourite to fly?
Yeah, I mean, when you got to the later marks of Hunter that had the 200 series Avon in it, the early models with the 100 series Avon, the engine was a wee bit fragile. And you could get compressor surges and things like that. But the 200 series engine was totally bulletproof, and it gave you another 2,500 pounds of thrust. So you got 10,000 pounds of thrust out of it. Of the later marks, that's the 6 and the 9 and the FR-10 as well. The 6 was by far and away the lightest of them. So doing aerobatics in a Mark 6 was absolutely superb. You got a lot of thrust and a lightweight aeroplane. And with just the 200-gallon drop tanks inboard, you got no speed limitations or G limitations at all.
Yeah.
So it was a 7G aeroplane. So it was great fun to fly.
And you mentioned there, Rod, the tanks, the extra tanks. Some of the stories and the ones that stick in my mind are the target practice using the drop tanks with water in
with water.
Them.
Yes.
You just couldn't do that sort of thing nowadays, could you?
I don't know. I can't see why not. I mean, filling drop tanks full of water is not over the top, is it?
but dropping it on some of the targets, again, a story that sticks in my mind is the radar vehicle that you set up to drop the tanks on you and your buddy. And when you got there the next morning, it had gone.
Yeah. Yeah, of course, this is all for practice. I mean, we didn't use them for real. They were, as far as I'm aware, it was never used for real. It's just for practice purposes.
Yeah.
But that radar truck that disappeared overnight was totally incredible. We'd blown the wheels off it, and it was sitting on the desert floor, and the next morning it had disappeared. and then left the tattiest, oldest 3-ton truck you've ever seen in the same spot.
But the most amazing thing about the story was, and it's non-flying, is this was a 40-ton radar truck, and it literally just disappeared into the desert.
Yeah, yeah. About 1,000 of the lads came along and nicked it, I think.
And some of those stories of flying back in Aden, on operational sorties and things like that. Again, one of the ones that springs to mind, thinking back when I was reading it last week, was firing rockets off at the machine gun posts and things like that. You almost lost it on that one, didn't you?
It was interesting because that was my first ever operational sortie, and I fired this pair of rockets, one from each wing. And, of course, if you're rolling when you fire, you impart a rolling motion to the rocket, either downwards or upwards. There was a bit of crosswind came in right at the last minute, which I counteracted with a bit of roll. And fortunately, the left rocket was a direct hit, but the right rocket missed the top of the ridge and went on forever.
Yeah, never to be seen again.
Absolutely.
You got some interesting stories about ferry flights back to the UK from Africa and the Middle East as well. They're quite intriguing. But on one return trip, I mentioned earlier, you became an instructor at OCU. And one of the things that I just wanted to ask you about, you mentioned in the book, is some of your students felt you were a little harsh in terms of your style.
Yeah.
Fighter or weenie, I think, was the thing that springs to mind from reading it. And they sort of all went around your back to your wife to mention it.
Yeah.
Now, it's quite interesting because we've just talked to the RAF's most senior flight instructor recently about what makes a fast jet pilot successful.
Yeah.
Were you being harsh, or was it something that you had to be strong to fight in the environment you were in?
Well, I have to say, I came through the old school that, you know, you sink or swim, and it's down to you entirely. And if you can't cope and you sink, hard luck. Yes, it was a hard school. There's no two ways about it. And whether that's still relevant today or not, of course, is a different debate entirely. But at the time, it definitely was relevant. Certainly people who were my instructors, people like Chris Goulds, who gave you a heck of a time if you didn't keep up, that was the kind of spirit that I worked with, I guess. And Dick Warmby's, the poor late Dick Warmby's statement that there are only two kinds of pilots in the world, fighter pilots and weenies can keep out. I'll go along with that.
You know, let's go back to the title of the book, All About Fun. The stories have pretty much all have an amusing angle to them. And I think that's what's quite captivating about the book. But you've had a long career, you know, a long time flying the Hunters. But that's not the only thing that you talk about in the book, is it?
No. I mean, I've been extremely lucky since I left the Air Force. And one of the decisions I made when I left the Air Force was not to go into a flying job, and still aviation related, but always on the ground, which gave me a lot of spare time. And I've been very fortunate to get involved in flying the big warbirds. So I've flown the majority of, or most of the big single engine piston engined aircraft, such as the Mustang and the Spitfire and aircraft like that, which has been superb.
Yeah, and of course the Spitfire features in the book, and you talk about the passion for that aircraft. Tell us a little bit about what it's like to fly. What's it feel like? You know, it's a schoolboy's dream.
Yeah, absolutely, it is. People always ask you what's the best thing about flying a Spitfire. Well, I always say the second best thing about flying a Spitfire is getting it airborne. The best thing is getting it back down on the ground in one piece, because they are unique and beautiful aeroplanes. But it's a delight. I mean, the Spitfire is, it's got its quirks. It's got a narrow track undercarriage. It doesn't particularly like crosswinds, but it's a pilot's aeroplane. It's like all British aircraft. It's a pilot's aeroplane. It's on your side. It's not trying to attack you as you go around flying it.
Yeah.
It's very, very responsive, but it will bite you, obviously, if you push it. And you know, crosswind landings are quite demanding if you get a strong crosswind, but other than that, it's an absolute joy to fly.
And what's you talk in various parts of the book about display flying, and again, one of the things that I you know, my tongue dropped out when I was reading and saw the pictures was the I think it was the Hunter display was it 34 aircraft spelling out the squadron number.
I 229. That was at Chibnall. Yes, we had 36 aircraft in that. We had 40 airborne. We had 4 spares as well. So we
as
had
one 40 does.
Yeah. Well, we had plenty of Mark 6 Hunters at Chibnall at the time. We put out 229, which was the number of the OCU, and so there were 9 aircraft in each formation. Sorry, no, there were 36. There were 12 aircraft in each formation. That's it. 36 of us. And that was fun.
And I suppose one of the things that brings me to is there's some fabulous photos in the book as well.
Yeah.
Are they all yours?
No, not all of them are mine. I mean, the vast majority of them are of me flying one way or another. But no, I've been a lot of photographers have been very kind, let me use their work in my book.
Yeah, it's great, great photography. So another reason to go and get a copy of this book. It's a fantastic read. Rod, where did your your flying career in the RAF end? Then what rank were you when you left the service?
I left as a squadron leader. My last tour in the Air Force proper was boss of a squadron, a training squadron down at Broadie, 79 squadron. Then my last 2 years was in Oman flying the Jaguar and the Hunter with the Sultan of Oman's Air Force on loan from the RAF.
And you've also, as you mentioned earlier, done some desk work. You've worked for the Civil Aviation Authority as well. Yeah. Whereabouts are you now in this great journey?
Nominally I'm retired. I spent the last 4 years full-time employment working for Farnborough International. The Flying Display Director for the 2010 and 2012 Farnborough Air Shows. And a couple of shows in Bahrain. But now I'm supposedly retired, but I'm doing a lot of flying display director work. I'm flying display director down at Shoreham for the Shoreham Air Show, which is fantastic. The Biggin Hill Air Show in June, Blackpool, and the Victory Show at Cosby. So I've got 4 shows that I'm looking after. And I'm display flying the Bulldog at the moment.
Wow, I was going to ask you what aircraft are you still flying, if any, but there you go. And before we leave it, Rod, what's your favourite story from the book?
that's always difficult, isn't it? You know, which is your favourite story? I think the one that sticks most in my mind are the 3 visits to the station commander's office in a 2-week period, which almost ended up in the of me losing my RAF career, I think.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, just laughing at those stories, as I said earlier, is a fantastic balance of humour, detail and real life experiences in the book.
Good.
So thank you very much for having your kids and your grandkids so that you could write it for us.
Well, thank you very much, Peter. I mean, the very kind comments, and I'm pleased that you like it.
No, I loved it, and I really would recommend people go out and get a copy. So we'll put links in our show notes to where they can go. Just before we go, Rod, anything else you'd like to add?
Well, again, thank you for promoting the book. I mean, I guess people should go for one of the rare unsigned copies, as Wogan would say. I've enjoyed writing it. I've enjoyed putting it together. I'd like it to have been about another 80,000 words, but John was insistent that 100,000 words was it. I've still got about 300 photographs that I needed to squeeze in somewhere. But room in the book meant we were curtailed on what we put in it.
Well, it is a great balance between some of the photos, the stories, as I said. But given some of the other things in your career, is there another book in Rod yet?
It might not be quite as exciting. I mean, when I left the Air Force, I worked for a flight simulator training company and then 15 years in the CEA and then Farnborough International. And I met some magic people and fantastic people there. But of course, there's not the necessarily the humor in it that there would be in the book as it's written at the moment. So I'm not sure. Maybe some more articles, but I'm not sure about another book.
Well, you can always take up after dinner speaking and telling jokes, because as I said, I laughed out loud at many of
good.
Them.
I do actually do a lot of talks to aviation societies and things like that, Royal Aeronautical Societies. I do a fair amount of that as well.
Well, Rod, thank you very much again for joining us. Where can we find you online, or shall I put some links in the show notes for that?
My youngest son keeps threatening to develop me a website, but I don't actually have one at the moment. But I hopefully will be getting a website before too much longer.
All right. Well, we'll keep track of that with Beth at Grub Street, and we'll as soon as it becomes live, we'll link up to it. Rod, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Peter.
So, hope you enjoyed that as much as I did talking to Rod there. What we didn't get the opportunity to do, because time literally ran out on us, was talk about some of the aircraft that he's flown, as well, of course, as the Hunter and the Jaguar. One very amusing story later on in the book is how he's flying a P-51 Mustang, the D model, and bounces two RAF Hawks outside Lucas as he's in the hold and has a dogfight with one of the Hawks. Great story. He also goes on to talk about some of the other aircraft he flew, including the Hurricane, the Corsair, the Wildcat, the Bearcat, the Sea Fury, the Stearman, Sky Raider, Texan, Harvard, Fokker Wolf 190, and on and on and on. So an absolutely fantastic read. Fascinating guy to talk to. Can't wait to get him back on the show. Anyway, hope you enjoyed listening to that. Now, before we leave Rod Dean, he did ask me to mention the Shoreham Air Show that's coming up in August. Show's been running for about 26 years now and has raised over £2 million for the Royal Air Force Association charity, and in particular had a fantastic year last year. Everyone involved in the air show is a volunteer and unpaid, and this year's display is on the 22nd and 23rd of August. Anything we can do to help promote that show, we like to do. So please do go over, look that up. And if you weren't planning to go there, go along. We're going to see if we can get the press team from the air show onto this program, maybe in a future episode to talk about the show. So 22nd, 23rd of August, please do go over, look them up, buy tickets and go and have a fab time.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society has a range of specialist groups which focus on a specific domain or discipline. They form a vital interface between the society and the world at large, and serve both the interests of enthusiasts and professionals through debate, conferences, lectures and other activities. Learn how you can get involved. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Now, our next interview is with Dr. Ron Smith. Of course, those who are in the industry in the UK will probably know Ron. He's a fascinating guy, has written many, many books on aviation, history and different aircraft types. But I wanted to pick his brain about a small booklet that he wrote called Westland, 100 Years of Aircraft Manufacturing at Yeovil. Of course, they are celebrating those 100 years this year in 2015. So I had the chance to talk to Ron about that paper, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes. It's free. It's a good 15 to 20 minute read. Tells you an awful lot about the aircraft and the aircraft types that were manufactured at Yeovil. We then go on to ask him about his latest book, D.H. Moth, A Family Album. Ron, welcome to Extended.
I'm pleased to be here. Nice to talk to you.
Well, thank you very much for taking some time out. Ron, for those listeners who don't know much about you, can you tell us a little bit about your aviation background and your career?
Certainly. I trained as an aeronautical engineer and started working at Westland Helicopters in 1975 on research aerodynamics. And after 5 years, I became head of future projects for the company, which was a role I continued until I left in early 1991. And after that, I went to British Aerospace, working initially on helicopter bid work and then subsequently actually on armoured fighting vehicles, and I've now retired. In terms of my aviation interests, I started taking photographs of aeroplanes when I was at school, so we're talking more than 50 years ago, and I've continued doing that. I learnt to fly in 1978. I've got about 770 hours, mostly tailwheel time. And I've owned five different aircraft, a number of them older than I am.
And Ron, just to put some of that flying into context, tell us about some of those aircraft types you've flown, because they're quite special.
Okay, well, I've taken off and landed 36 different types of aircraft, of which I've flown about half solo. And I suppose I learned to fly on Cessnas, as many people do. My tailwheel checkout was on the Tiger Moth, and I've flown a number of older aeroplanes. I owned a 1938 Tipsy Trainer, and I've flown a friend's 1940 Tailorcraft Oster 1, I've flown the Piper Cub, Stearman, just a range of mostly old aircraft. I've owned two Jodels and two Luscombe Silvairs, as well as the Tipsy. and had enormous fun out of it.
Yeah. And you've got a very active extracurricular career, I suppose, with the Royal Aeronautical Society as well, don't you?
Yes, I when I was working for Westlands, I was nominated as a member of the Aeronautical Society Rotorcraft Committee, which I subsequently chaired. And after that, when I stopped working on helicopters, I started writing aviation books, including a series called British Built Aircraft. And that drew me to the attention of the historical group of the Royal Aeronautical Society. And I'm a member of the historical group committee. And I'm a fellow of the Aeronautical Society, and I'm very pleased to say that I was nominated or proposed for that role by Eric Winkle Brown, who had been a member of my Rotorcraft Committee when I was chairing it.
Wow, he's been a guest on the show, and I think whenever we talk about Winkle, as he's affectionately known, everyone knows him, and let's hope that he gets some recognition as well. But Ron, we're here today to talk about Westland. 2015 sees the celebration of 100 years of aircraft manufacturing at Yeovil by Westland, and you've written a brief but really interesting summary of those 100 years. Can you take us through those 100 years and pick out some of those highlights, lowlights, and some of the aircraft that Westland have developed? Because I learnt so much from reading your article, and was prompted to ask you a few questions, but maybe you can take us through some of that history.
Yeah, certainly. To begin at the beginning, Westlands has its origins in a company called Petters Limited, and for many years it wasn't called Westland Aircraft. It was actually called the Westland Aircraft Works of Petters Limited.
Right, okay.
And the origin goes back to 1915, when there was a massive expansion of contract production of aircraft to support the needs of the First World War. And in April 1915, the directors of Petters wrote to the Admiralty and the War Office offering their services in any way that would be useful to the war effort. And they were asked if they would build aircraft. And they started off by building short seaplanes, the short 184 and the short 166. And then they went on to build a number of other types. Notably, they were responsible for the manufacture of the Airco de Havilland DH-9A, which was a DH-9 with an American Liberty engine. And they built a significant number of those. They also built the Vickers Vimy, 25 Vickers Vimys. And, as I say, at least 350 DH-9A, which was actually quite important for the future of the company, as we'll see shortly.
Yeah, yeah. As a helicopter passes overhead, probably a Lynx by the sound of things, off on its way to Yeovil, I would imagine. And just asking you a question there, Ron, have they always been based at Yeovil?
Yes, the company was based in Yeovil. The Petters were originally at the Nautilus Works, which is on Reckleford in Yeovil. They never left Yeovil, but they had additional factories, which they had at Weston-super-Mare and Cowes on the Isle of Wight after they had acquired the Saunders Row and Bristol helicopter interests after the merger of the business or the rotorcraft sector in the 1960s. But originally, Westlands were essentially just at Yeovil with local subcontractors.
Yeah. And on the location they are now, not at HMS Heron, no, where the naval base is.
They have always been on the same site. The airfield was smaller originally and was extended, particularly, I think, when Westlands were building Spitfire and Seafire aircraft during the Second World War. And some of their prototypes, for that reason, didn't make their first flights at Westlands. So some of the larger and heavier aircraft built between the wars were flown at either Andover or Boscombe Down, for example. Yeah. But the factory and the activity was always at Yeovil on the same site.
And just talking about some of those aircraft and also some of the developments, I noticed in your brief summary that Westland also built pianos and limousines, amongst other things. But I suppose the key thing about Westland is they always seem to have been there not only to develop their own aircraft, rotary or fixed wing, but started off doing an awful lot of builds on behalf of others, and that's really continued right through their history, hasn't it?
Yes, in a way. I think that there's two phases. At the beginning, they didn't build aircraft, and so it was inevitable that they built other people's designs.
Yeah.
And that is true across the whole of the British industry. There were furniture manufacturers and car makers and all sorts of allied trades who suddenly found themselves committed to building aircraft during the First World War because of the very rapid increase in production required.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then later on, after the Second World War, when they made a decision to switch from fixed-wing aircraft to rotary-wing helicopters, again, they had no basis of design in-house, and they started building Sikorsky products under licence, and they were very fortunate in that the terms of the licence allowed them to significantly develop those products,
yeah,
with the result that, you know, Westland Sea Kings are quite a different animal from Sikorsky Sea Kings, and
yeah,
Westland Wessexes are quite different from Sikorsky S-58, not least because they're pretty much all turbine-powered as opposed to the piston-engine Sikorskys.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's go on to talk about that sort of pre-war and Second World War era that that Westland was very influential in, and I really didn't appreciate quite how much. They built a staggering number of Spitfires. I think they built the majority of the Seafires.
Yes.
And just personally for me, they built some Fairey Barracudas, an aircraft my dad flew in during the war. So very pleased to have seen that as well. But also some rather unusual aircraft. One that sticks in my mind is the Wyvern.
Yes. Okay, well, after the First World War, like many other companies, they suffered an enormous cutback in requirements. And they were very lucky in the fact that, having taken responsibility for the DH-9A, when the Army decided, when the Army decided they needed a corporation aircraft for all general purposes,
yeah,
Westlands were able to bring forward the Wapiti, which was a development of the DH-9A. And they built more than 400 of those for the RAF, and subsequently also developed it to the Westland Wallace in between, just as an aside, creating the Westland PV-3, which was the first aircraft to fly over Mount Everest. So during the interwar years, they had the cushion of the Wapiti and Wallace, long-standing production, which many other firms didn't. But they also, perhaps less well known, they were the main production manufacturer of the Hawker Hector, and really it should be called the Westland Hector because all 178 aircraft were actually built by Westlands.
Yeah, and one that jumped out at me, and I now only remember it because as a boy I saw it hanging from the ceilings, is the Pterodactyl.
Mm. Well, Westlands, there was a chap called Professor G.T.R. Hill who was interested in tailless aircraft, and Westlands became engaged to produce experimental aircraft of his design, and they produced first the Pterodactyl 1, which is the aircraft that's currently on display in the Science Museum in London. But they went on to produce progressive developments, ending up with fairly exotic Pterodactyl 5, which was had a goshawk engine, I think, in the nose, and had a space in the rear for a turret with an almost unrestricted rearward field of fire, and was quite a powerful aeroplane, and is reported to pretty much have been comparable in performance to the Hawker Demon. It must have looked and sounded fantastic. I mean, I would really love to have seen one flying.
It's certainly an unusual looking aircraft, and I suppose that's also been a bit of a Westland seems to have produced iconic aircraft.
Yes,
let's
I
put
think
it that
so.
Way
yes
and of course the Lysander.
I think
one of those.
The Lysander is really the most famous product of the company, and something around 1500, 1600 were built, and designed for Army Corporation and used for things like target towing, but most famously used for the insertion of special operations executive people into France and the occupied territories. and you know, doing enormous service and much loved because of it.
Yeah.
And with a very distinctive, I think iconic is a good word. You just look at the shape of the wing and you think, oh, that's a Lysander.
Yeah.
And quite a powerful aeroplane. I knew a chap called Martin Holloway who used to fly one, and he said that it, with 1,000 horsepower, it was quite sporty, but you had to keep an eye on the fuel.
It's a big old chunky aircraft,
it's huge,
wasn't it? Yeah.
It's
not small.
When I had my aircraft at Henstridge, Brian Woodford had a collection of aircraft there, including the Lysander. And the Lysander would share the hangar with a twin-engine aircraft called the de Havilland Dragonfly.
Yeah.
And the top wing of the Lysander went clear over the top of the de Havilland Dragonfly. No problem at all.
Yeah.
And it's not surprising that it had to be equipped with a ladder to allow people to get in and out and out quickly.
And any boy who built Airfix models would know that. Mm-hmm. And again, the whole war years proved to be very influential in the development of Westland's business. As I mentioned, you know, the manufacturing of the Spitfires, the Seafires.
I think that's people associate Westland's with the Lysander, and they associate it with helicopters. But what they don't really realise is that they were so important to the Supermarine Seafire. And in fact, where Castle Bromwich built more than half of all the Spitfires that were built, Westland's built more than half of all the Seafires that were built.
Yeah.
And in fact, a really very significant contribution. They did build Spitfires, but their Seafire production was something like 1,376 aircraft out of a total of 2,000.
It's quite amazing.
Seafires.
That is, yeah, that's quite amazing.
So, you know, really, that was the centre of their war effort. And although they produced the Westland Whirlwind Fighter, there were only 114 of those. Mm. They produced the Westland Welkin, which is a high altitude aircraft, which was not really very successful. And so they were not really building their own designs during the war. Their contribution to the war effort was Spitfires and Seafires and, of course, the Lysander.
Yeah. Let me ask you then about the Wyvern. It is an unusual aircraft, not very successful, but I always remember it in some of the old books, in a corner somewhere.
I think I would call it imposing or dominant. It's a very powerful-looking aircraft with the twin contra-rotating propellers of its Python turboprop engine. There is a saying in the aircraft industry that it's never a good thing to combine a new airframe with a new engine, particularly if the engine is unproven.
Yeah.
And the problem that the Wyvern had was it took a long time in development, and actually it was 7 years in development and only 4 years in service.
Yeah.
And anyone who's read Harold Penrose's books, including his autobiography and Adventure with Fate, will realise that it was very much viewed as a with mixed feelings by Harold Penrose because of the number of test pilots who were killed or injured with problems with the Wyvern aircraft.
And did that in any way influence Westland's decision, I suppose, to go along the route of rotary aircraft rather than fixed wing?
That's something which I am not clear on. There clearly was an important decision by the company that they were not going to pursue conventional fixed-wing aircraft, maybe because there were so many other really well-established firms out there who were all fighting for business post-war.
Yeah.
And the Sikorsky hoverfly and subsequent developments were showing sufficient promise that the UK clearly needed, from a government point of view, to have a route into the helicopter business.
Yeah.
And whereas Bristol were designing the Bristol Sycamore, for example, Westland's actually never designed. They had no helicopter background at the time when they went into helicopter license production. And the advantage of licensing was that they could get licensed in terms of the products. So you got a full set of drawings for the product, and you also have all of the manufacturing processes defined, and so you can be reasonably sure that, you know, if you follow the processes, you will result in successful aircraft. But as they started with the S-51 Dragonfly, But almost as soon as they started, the aircraft became modified for English use. So they used the Alvis Leonides engine instead of the Pratt & Whitney engine. They developed the Dragonfly into the Widgeon, which was their own design for civil use.
Yeah.
And then went on to the Whirlwind, again, starting building initially the American aircraft with its piston engine and its little butterfly, inverted butterfly tail. And then they put in turboprop engines, so the Gnome engine. And again, the vast majority of Whirlwinds built were actually turboprop or turboshaft powered, and quite a different animal from the American ones.
Yeah. Is that why they proved so successful over here?
I think so. I think that at the end of the day, they produced aircraft that kept up with the technology.
Yeah.
The American-built S-55 never really developed into anything else. Similarly, the S-58, which remained in the US piston-engine airplane, became either Eland or Gnome-powered with the with Westland Wessex.
Yeah.
And they sold very well all over the world. I think one of the most striking things with Westlands was their export success with these models.
Yeah.
And if you go to the Sea King, you find that the aircraft was substantially developed in terms of increased weight. So I think the Sea King was originally around 20,000 pounds all up weight, and the last Westland models were around 24,000 pounds. They had different construction. They developed the tail rotor with cambered tail rotor blades. They put composite main rotor blades on. The aircraft continued to evolve. And I think Sikorsky were used to the US government coming along and ordering, we'll have 1,000 of these.
Yeah.
Whereas Westlands were prepared to produce 10 aircraft for Pakistan, say, which were tailored to that company's needs. And that was very popular in terms of the export success of the aircraft.
And again, some of those aircraft you described there, I can only describe, certainly in my own mind, as being very iconic. Of course, the Wessex models in its various forms, the Whirlwind, the Scout, the Wasp, and the Sea King. Maybe because I'm anglicised, but I do associate very much with Westland rather than Sikorsky.
Well, I think if you think about survivors being rescued at sea from a ship, in horrendous conditions, the image that comes into your mind is one of those Royal Navy Cold Rose Sea Kings, hovering in atrocious conditions.
Let's move on then to, I suppose, the troubles of the 80s and then coming into the 90s. What happened to Westland, Ron?
Right. Well, without speculating...
Being political.
Without speculating too much. I mean, Westland had acquired the helicopter businesses of Bristol and Saunders Row, and that saw them, and Fairey Aviation.
Yeah.
And that saw them building the Scout and the Wasp, which originated with Saunders Row. And then they used the Fairey facilities at Hayes for building the Puma.
Yeah.
And things were going very well. And I think they got to a point in the mid-80s where... They had a financial crisis, and I don't want to speculate on the causes of the crisis, but the upshot was a lot of government interest resulted in Heseltine resigning from the cabinet because he wanted a European solution. And in the short term, Sikorsky took a small interest in the company, and the company took a license for the Black Hawk.
Mm.
But I think Sikorsky had learnt that the terms under which they allowed Westlands to develop their other products had actually been to the disadvantage of Sikorsky.
Yeah.
And the Black Hawk, only two aircraft were built as kits, and it was never successful. But it got the company past a crisis. And then ultimately, my recollection is that the Sikorsky shares were sold to GKN.
Yeah.
The company became GKN Westland Helicopters, and then a share, 50% share, was taken by Finmeccanica Augusta, and so it was Augusta Westland with a 50-50 UK holding.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then ultimately the Italians bought out GKN, and the company became wholly owned by Augusta Finmeccanica. When I joined the company in 75, they were thinking about replacing the Sea King.
Right.
There was a project called Multi-Role Fleet Helicopter, which later became known as SKR Sea King Replacement. And the company was working up designs around anti-submarine warfare helicopters for the Navy. It turned out that the Italians had similar requirements for anti-submarine working in the Mediterranean. Now, there were differences between the two, but the governments and the companies started to talk and exchange information about their products. And the end result was the EH-101.
Yeah.
And the EH-101 has evolved into the Merlin and has become the mainstay of the company's business. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, the services have been rationalizing to a smaller number of different types of helicopter. And so in the medium, large to medium size, basically the Merlin has become the aircraft of choice.
Yeah.
It's replacing the Sea King in the commando role shortly. It's the main anti-submarine helicopter for the Navy. It's one of the important medium lift helicopters for the RAF. I mean, the RAF is effectively going Chinook, Merlin, and the Puma upgrade. And so Merlin remains a mainstay in both domestic and export markets. Lynx, which began production in 75, has been developed and is now flying with new engines, the T-800 engines, as Superlynx, and the Superlynx has been developed into the Augusta Westland Wildcat, which is being procured for both, again, Army and Navy service.
And are they all being built here, the Wildcats?
Yes. I believe so.
Yeah.
Having left the company 20-odd years ago,
yeah.
I can't... recently, I had a walk around the production line and the flight sheds. As far as I know, all of the Wildcats are being built here.
Yeah. Quite an impressive aircraft, that, isn't it?
Certainly.
It looks like the old Lynx, but is nothing like it inside.
Absolutely. Completely upgraded in terms of avionics and systems and cockpits and so on. And you know, I think that's the thing that Westland has done. It's carried forward technology in its products. It was doing it when it started building helicopters, and it's doing it today.
Right, okay. Ron, I want to leave Westland there because I want to ask you a little bit about some of your books. Some say the definitive guide to British aircraft manufacturing, the five volumes you've written for those show all aircraft types up to 2005.
Yes, I mean, the background to this book series, which is called British Built Aircraft, was a flying competition called the Dawn to Dusk Trophy, which was invented by the Duke of Edinburgh when he was a member of the Tiger Club.
Yeah.
And you have to take an aircraft and do something interesting in the course of the hours of daylight in a single day. And you have to spend a minimum of 8 hours of the day in the air. And I had the idea of flying around Britain in a suitably old aeroplane over locations where aircraft used to be built by companies that no longer, by and large, exist. And I managed to persuade one of my work colleagues, who is a very experienced pilot and very well connected, to find an aeroplane for us to use. And we borrowed for a week a de Havilland Hornet Moth, 60-year-old biplane.
Beautiful.
And we flew 650 nautical miles around the country on a route with more than 40 turning points and entered the competition, and somewhat to our surprise, won the Dawn to Dusk Trophy. And I was then persuaded that this was quite a significant piece of research that I'd done. Now, that really was the starting point. If I'd known how much more research was required to capture the whole picture, maybe I wouldn't have started down the road.
There's
five volumes, and they deal regionally with different locations. So there is a volume dealing with aircraft production in Greater London.
Yeah.
Now, it might be a surprise to think that there's enough aircraft production to fill a volume, but I mean, there's a book to itself on aircraft produced in London. And then, similarly, the aircraft companies in southwest and central southern England, in southeast England, and so on. And it took me to five volumes. And
so anyone who says the British haven't got a heritage in aircraft manufacturing need to read those five volumes. Well,
and each volume starts with a description of how the business evolved so that it eventually coalesced into British Aerospace, which contains much, if not definitely not all, but much of the heritage of the industry is contained within British Aerospace.
Yeah.
And on the way, I discovered a great deal about aircraft production under contract, particularly during the First World War, and I found that very interesting. And I think quite a lot of what has been what I presented there was not generally known, because after the First World War, the business contracted to around 15 or 16 companies who formed the Society of British Aircraft Constructors, as it was known then. And those are all the big names that you know, Bristol and de Havilland and things like that. And the many other companies that made a huge contribution to aircraft construction that are simply thought of today as car dealers, like Man Edgerton Limited, things like that.
I didn't know that.
So I found that of great interest and not particularly recorded elsewhere.
And you've written a book with your brother.
I've written a memoir. Yeah. I have an identical twin brother where I worked in industry. He worked for the Ministry of Defence and was in the British Embassy in Washington for a while, and is now working as a senior member of the staff on the Australian Defence Science and Technology Organisation.
Right.
And we had quite a lot of fun when we were younger, working in the margins of the aircraft industry, because we had an uncle who was able to find us holiday work in such companies as Personal Plane Services, who are well known for building aircraft for those magnificent men and their flying machines and so on, and also for Field Aircraft Services Executive Jet Centre at Heathrow. So we have experience of picking mushrooms in the middle of Heathrow, which is not an everyday occurrence.
It is a great read. I must say, and you've not stopped there. There's many other books in you, but there's two in the pipeline I particularly want you to tell us about, because one will be out very, very soon, if not when airs.
Due out by the end of May is a book called De Havilland Moths, a family album, and it's basically a photographic record of any of the de Havilland aircraft that have the word moth in the aircraft product name. And it's made up largely of my own photographs, but it's augmented by some photographs from the de Havilland and British Aerospace Heritage Archive, because I work for them on a voluntary basis. So I've struck an agreement with them to make use of some of their photographs in this book. So that is out, published by Destin World at the end of May.
Our good friend Matt Forkus, I've seen some of the photos. You've very kindly showed me a draft of it. Very, very impressive. Anyone who loves those aircraft, this is going to have to be one of the ones for your shelf.
And the other book, which I'm quite pleased about, again, it's taken me to a different world, in the sense that it's an American publisher, Schiffer Publishing, who are well known and respected for their aviation books. And it's called Classic Light Aircraft, and it's a 416-page hardback covering about 850 types of light aircraft. Again, predominantly my own and my brother's photographs. There's probably around 5% of photographs from other sources.
Yeah.
And it's due out, I believe its American publication date is the 28th of July, and that's already listed on Amazon for pre-order. So I feel a sense of reality about it, because
out on Amazon, it must be coming now.
I've just done what I believe to be the final proofing of it, and so it will be going to print very shortly.
Right. Ron, we're going to put some links to those in the show notes. Thank you very much for joining us. We talked a little longer than I'd hoped, but I'm very, very grateful for your time.
That's fine. I've enjoyed it, and I hope that people find it very interesting.
Just before we go, where can we find out a bit more about you online?
Well, there is a joint website with my twin brother, which was set up by the publishers of our memoir, which is called Two Up, and the website is www.ronandjimsmith.com.
Right, okay. We'll put links to that in the show notes.
And I've also got a Twitter presence as Dr. Ron.
Ah, I didn't know that. We'll have to follow you.
Which is at GBHVF Ron.
Right, okay. We'll put links to that in the show notes too. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.
So I hope you enjoyed that chat with Ron Smith. Fascinating guy. Wonderful free historical article that he's written. It's available in PDF format. We'll put a link in the show notes for you to download that. And of course, he also talked there about his latest book, De Havilland Moths, A Family Album, which is published now. Ron did mention to me just before we recorded this that they are now available and available on Amazon. If you're going to buy it from Amazon, why not use the extended link? We get a very small percentage payback, not from Ron. He gets what he gets, but we get that from Amazon by providing that link to you. Costs you nothing more. Just go through our link. Okay, thanks very much again, Ron, for that. After the break, we talk to René Verjean. Listed in the Sunday Times top 10 geeky holiday spots on the planet, no other single location in the world has contributed so much to the development of aeronautical science over such a long period of time, and that is, of course, Farnborough.
The aircraft we do have all have our XREE experimental aircraft. So the Jaguar we have did an enormous amount of work on head-up displays. The Hunter we have did all the low-level FLIR work. The Puma we have was an experimental Puma, structural experimental flying Puma here. And the Gnat was a structural test aircraft. The Harrier T2 we've got was a EMC, electromagnetic compatibility aircraft.
You can see all of these at the Farnborough Air Sciences Trust Museum. And the greatest thing about the Farnborough Air Sciences Trust Museum is it's free. Go and visit them at airsciences.org.uk to find out more. And if you can get to the south of England, you shouldn't miss this. René, welcome to Extended.
Thank you, Peter, for the invitation to your show.
Oh, it's great. It's great to have you on. You run a fabulous website called aviationbookreviews.com. And when I first saw it a few years ago, it was good. Now it looks like you're really busy. You've got some great reviews on there. When did you start the site and why?
Well, I think it was in 2010 that I had a big exercise at night at Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam. And when I was looking for a newspaper, I couldn't find any. And well, instead of the newspaper, I choose a book with an aircraft on it. And that book is called Vulcan 607 from Roland White.
Great book.
Great book. And I read it, of course, became enthusiastic about the storyline. And I thought, well, let's write a short review for the magazine of my flight club here at Amsterdam Hilversum.
Right, okay.
And due to that book from Roland White, I got enthusiastic about the Falklands War. And I read the next book about the Falklands War, called Sea Harrier Over the Falklands from Commander Sharkey Ward. And yeah. I also wrote a review on that book. And, well, I thought, let's try to write a review for all new editions of the Flight Club magazine. And, I did it. And after a year, so from 2011, I put the reviews on the internet, on a blog, and we are now 4 years later, and I think we have more than 100 reviews at the moment.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about how the website works and what we can find on it.
Yeah, well, it works quite simple. You go to aviationbooks.com and you can find lots of categories on the different kinds of books we have, like aviation history, aviation humor. We have books for children, We have books on development, war, history, military, aviation, and so on. And depending on what you like, you get the books and the reviews in front of you.
Right. Okay. And who's writing the reviews at the moment?
Well, in the beginning, I was the only writer. But after, I think, 60 reviews, I became a little, bit exhausted. And sorry for the word. We have a team right now, built up from a few reviewers or pilots.
And do you look for people to comment on the reviews or to contribute to the reviews in any way on the website?
It is always possible to make a comment on a review. And what is also possible that is that people send in their review. So if anyone reads a nice book, he or she can write a nice review on it, independent.
And submit it to the website? And then submit it up to your website?
Yes, submit it to my email account.
Right,
and,
okay.
Well, we get in touch with each other, and I can place it on my website. And, of course, the credits from the review is for the person who sends it in.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm sure we've got lots of listeners, and I know that particularly on Facebook and on some other forums, there are some great book readers out there in the in the sector who may want to contribute. So we'll put some links in the show notes so that people can do that. But I suppose what listeners will want to know is what books are currently up on the site being reviewed.
Well, that's quite difficult. It was difficult for me to choose some, but in the end, I have a few. I like the Top Gun book, Top Gun Days, from Baranek, who was on your show a few weeks ago.
Yeah, that's right. What a wonderful guy.
Yes, it is. And the book is also great.
Yes, it is.
What also is a very nice book is Spitfire on My Tail. Maybe you know it, but it is from Peter Osborne, and he wrote it together with Ulrich Steinhilper, and it is a Messerschmitt pilot from World War II. Great book.
Yeah.
And we have. I like some images of war books on the Royal Air Force in the Cold War, for example, and the Naval Aviation in World War. Great books. Currently, I'm reading a book from a Canadian writer called Danielle Metcalfe Chanel, and she has a book, written a book about polar winds, a century of flying in the north, and it is about aviation above the sixth parallel in Canada.
Wow,
it's also a great book.
Sounds interesting.
And the review will be posted on my website in a few weeks, I think. Great book,
Right, okay. And anyone who goes to the website can see the number of books that you've got there. It's also very visual as well. As I look at the website now, you've got all the book covers on there. You've got all the categories. It's quite an interesting site to actually just visit and browse around. What plans have you got, Rani, for the website in the future?
Plans is that we continue to grow steadily, and we want to become one of the major portals in the world that has been put on paper about aviation. And we want to to reveal the vast spectrum of aviation books by reviewing them.
Right. Okay. And as I say, there's a fantastic spectrum of books on there. Anyone who wants to contribute will have links in the show notes for you to do that. Are you also on Twitter, Rani?
Yes. Everybody can find us on Facebook and Twitter. If you type aviationbookreviews.com or aviationbookreviews, people can find us. You get informed about the latest
books being reviewed. And for those who are not native English speakers, you also have the website in Dutch and German as well, don't you?
Yes, the website was originally written in Dutch, but it is, of course, we are living in a very cosmopolitan world these days. So all the English books have an English review. So it is in two languages, and from every review that has been posted on the website, there is a copy in Dutch going to the Flight Club magazine of my flight club in Amsterdam.
Yeah, okay.
And, well, that's the way we do it.
Wonderful. Well, Ray, thank you very much for joining us today. Is there anything else you want to say to the listeners just before we sign off?
Well, just stay passionate about aviation and become a little bit more passionate about reading books.
That's a great recommendation. René, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for being on the show, Peter. And I wish you lots of success with your internet radio program.
Thank you. So if you're interested in aviation books and reviews, why not go over to aviationbookreviews.com or contact René. He's a fabulous guy, as you've heard there, absolutely passionate about aviation books. He might well have reviewed your book that you're interested in. If not, why not help him out? And when you've read it, provide a review for him. So René, thank you very much for joining us.
Listen, I haven't got long. It's about The Aviation Historian, the magazine the mainstream monthlies don't want you to know about. It's a new compact format quarterly journal, exploring the less well-known paths of flying history. It's created by experienced, award-winning former Aeroplane magazine editors Mick Oakey and Nick Stroud. It's not in the shops, but you can get it via the website, theaviationhistorian.com.
We know you're in there.
They're coming for me. I've got to go. Remember, The Aviation Historian.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
Okay, a bit of a change in tack now. Still talking about aviation and aerospace books. But I asked Simon Jakubowski from the Aviation Enthusiast Book Club which books he'd recommend as good reads. Not necessarily the top 10, but 10 books he thought we should recommend. So here we go, a quick run through of Simon's 10 books. Number 10, Lightning, 1954 to 2014, written by Ian Black and published by Fire Street Books. Simon says, a stunning photographic tribute to the great British Interceptor, a gorgeous coffee table book by renowned pilot and photographer Ian Black. Number 9, The Phantom in Focus, David Gledhill, of course, Fonthill Media, an outstanding account by a former F4 navigator and instructor of flying, operating and fighting a frontline jet fighter. This book has the best description of the roles and tasks carried out by the RAF in Germany I've read to date. Number 8, Aviation at the Edge. That's by John Flexman and it's published by Memoirs Publishing. Simon says, the amazing story of one man's 42-year flying career from joining the Fleet Air Arm through to bush flying in Africa and on to transporting celebrities in style. Number 7, Biggin Hill Airfield, Beyond the Bump. That's written by Joseph Merchant and it's published by Pilot's Pals. Part 1 of the story of what happened at Royal Air Force Station Biggin Hill during its final days as an operational fighter station, the preceding years back to the early 50s and the post-military era. Number 6, Short Sterling, The Owner's Workshop Manual. That's published by Haynes and written by Jonathan Faulkner. A long overdue book on one of Bomber Command's lesser known workhorses, a very well researched and laid out volume, which I found a very interesting diversion from the numerous Lancaster titles on the market. Number 5,
Wings on My Sleeve by Captain Eric Winkle Brown, of course published by Phoenix Books. An amazing book by an amazing pilot, Simon says. A career that reads better than any boy's own adventure. It's simply stunning how much this man achieved and what has to be the most varied military career in history. Number 4. Empire of the Clouds, that's by James Hamilton Patterson and it's published by Faber and Faber. A book that to my knowledge has received nothing but positive reviews, a recollection of the golden age of British aviation and its subsequent downfall, wonderfully told by the author. Number 3, Chicken Hawk by Robert Mason, published by Transworld Publishing. Personal favourite, this one, a riveting account of one man's tour of duty flying the iconic Huey helicopter in the Vietnam War. Simply stunning to read. Number 2, Thud Ridge by Colonel Jack Broughton, and that's by Cressy Publishing. An outstanding book on the hard-fought battles in the skies over Vietnam by the men flying the F-105 fighter bomber. Fast-paced flying scenes mixed with the horrors, tragedies and victories that come with combat flying. And number 1, Vulcan 607, Roland White, published by Corgi. A brilliant and well-described account of undoubtedly one of the most amazing combat missions ever undertaken. The story really comes to life in this book with great descriptions of the logistics involved in making history. And there it is. That is 10 books recommended by Simon. And Simon runs the Aviation Enthusiast Book Club on Facebook. It's a Facebook group, Simon Jakubowski. Thank you very much, Simon, for providing those 10 reads. What do you think about those 10? Would you change them? Would you add? What are your 10? Why not write into us, email us, tweet us, or post something onto Facebook? Or better still, why not put something on the Aviation Enthusiast Book Club on the Facebook group? We'll put a link to that in the show notes. Thanks again, Simon.
G'day, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran from Plane Crazy Down Under.
And you're listening to Extended.
And finally, we have an interview with John Davis, Head of Military Aviation at Grub Street Books. And we're going to look at some of the books they have in their portfolio. John, welcome to Extended.
Thank you. Good to be here.
John, tell me a little bit about, before we talk aviation, tell me a little bit about Grub Street Books and your profile within the aviation and aerospace and history sector.
Okay, sure. Well, we started Grub Street. It's a movable feast, actually, Peter. We started the company in 1982, way, way back. But we did at that time what's called packaged books for other publishers. And that meant that we would get the project together, we'd get an author together, we'd get photography together, artwork if needed. And then we would sell it on to a publisher such as Macmillan, Bantam Press, Penguin. And I always wanted to work in the aviation field because, my degree was history, but I got interested in aviation and really the pilots. So when we started in 82, we did some packaging of military aviation, but we really started getting going in 86 with some titles with Christopher Shores and Norman Franks. And so we've been publishing military aviation books solidly since then.
And you've got over, I think, 100 publications at the moment running just in the aviation and the historical area. Let's look at some of those. Of course, earlier in the program, we spoke to Rod. Really enjoyed it. Of course, Tony was featured in a recent episode, an episode that turned out to be probably our most popular episode ever, which just sort of states how much interest there is out there. Tell us about some of your other authors and some of the other books that you've got that are available.
Okay. It's only recently that we started on with the Boys series, which has been terrific for us, and I've really enjoyed that. I mean, up until that point, I was solidly in World War One and World War Two aviation, and the great authors in World War Two that I've already mentioned that I've always respected is Chris Shores and his team and Norman Franks. And so really from the 80s and then through the 90s, we were publishing books like Aces High, which was Chris Shores' great book, and also his books on Malta Spitfire Year, Malta Hurricane Years, Air War for Yugoslavia. And they've done so well for us. I mean, they are still in print. They first came out in about 1986, and I've kept them in print. So we've got the really excellent, specially researched books. But now with the more up-to-date list of boys, it started with Richard Pike's Lightning Boys.
Okay.
And we then realised that we could put that really that principle to many aircraft, provided we could get a very good lead author who could gather contributors. And so we've done that. We did Buccaneer Boys with Graham Pitchfork, which was excellent. We've done the three V books, all by Tony Blackman, Vulcan, Vegan. My sorry, edit that one out. Vulcan, Victor, and Valiant, and two Lightning Boys now, Jaguar Boys with Ian Hall, and so the series goes on. We've just had Phantom Boys. I'm very, very, very much looking forward to Harrier Boys, which comes out in July. Next year, Tornado, with a couple of chapters from women pilots, which is terrific. And we're going to do a Meteor Boys. Meteor Boys. Just been talking to Steve Bond, actually, who's putting that one together. And Norman Tebbit has agreed to write a chapter to it. So that should be fascinating. Steve has come up with 40X Meteor ground and air crew, which is terrific. Wow. When you think when it started flying. So that's really, we're really enjoying doing that. The other end of the scale, I've got some, I've developed a little World War One classics list. I started off with Arthur Gould Lee's Open Cockpit and No Parachute. I've got W.V. Yeats's Winged Victory, which is terrific. It's probably my only foray into fiction, to be honest, Peter.
Right, okay, because predominantly this is non-fiction.
Yeah, absolutely right. And then I've got I Chose the Sky coming into press now, which is Titch Rochford. And I've got Norman Macmillan's Into the Blue. So we're building that one up as well. So we're quite vibrant at the moment.
Yeah, and you've got some specials. You've got some signed books as well. So, you know, for the enthusiast who's really interested in getting a little bit more, you've got some opportunities for people to get signed copies.
Yeah, we have, and I think that they're up on our website now. Yes, what we try to do, we try to launch the books at either Duxford or Shoreham and get some veterans along. I mean, some of the guys, the Harrier guys, don't like to be called veterans, but they are, in fact. And so we'd get, say, half a dozen. And part of the excitement really is to have the guys sit down, tell their stories to the customers, but also to sign books. So yeah, we've got signed Vulcan books, we've got signed Phantom Boys books now, and quite a few signed Lightning. So throughout that series, we've got signatures on them of people who operated the aircraft.
Yeah. Now, this is a very unfair question, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
Right.
What's your favourite era, your favourite aircraft? Do you have a particular one, John, that you personally like?
Well, that's a very interesting question, Peter, because for me, it's actually the stories of the guys themselves that interest me. Not so much, and I shouldn't be saying this, but it's not so much the aircraft themselves and what their, you know, performance levels are, etc., etc. It really is the chaps, and I suppose I've got to say it's World War II. That was when I think that generation were tested more than any other, and that's what really interests me. I mean, what would I have done? What would any of my friends have done? And I'm always fascinated talking to these chaps and finding, you know, their experiences. There are fewer and fewer of them, really. But I mean, I think they're now around to talk to. But so I think that's still my favourite area, really, Peter.
Right. Okay. And you mentioned there some air shows, but also some events that you're going to be at, particularly this summer in the UK. Mm. Any to mention that people might be able to meet up with you and possibly some of the authors at?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we've got we do quite a lot with the Aviation Bookshop, Simon and Justin there. They're really good value. So at Duxford, the July Duxford, we're launching Bob Marston's Harrier Boys, and I've just just got the list from Bob this morning, and we've got six of the Harrier pilots there on the Saturday, and another wow. five on the Sunday. That's terrific.
Excellent.
We're doing a September Duxford, where I'm launching Harrier Hurricane Survivors. And I'm also going to be at Shoreham. They brought it forward this year, but we're there. And one that I really always like to do is Little Grandston with Dave Poyle on August 30th, because he raises so much money for children in need. And I'll have a little table there with Tony Blackman again. We tend to do a bit of a road show, Peter, Tony and I. And, so we're going to be at Wellesbourne on, funnily enough, on Father's Day, much to the chagrin of my wife and daughter, but we'll be there. Tony and I will be there because the Vulcan will be running up then. But yeah, we're going to be at Tangmere in August. We always go down there. It's a lovely event. So that's their main summer event.
Okay.
See a lot of our customers down there.
Wonderful, wonderful. Okay, John, the other thing I'd like to ask you is any special offers, any special editions that our listeners can get access to? I noticed there are a few items for sale on your website. Any other special offers or opportunities?
Well, apart from the signed ones, which we've talked about, we are doing a special offer on the 3V bomber books, Victor, Valiant and Vulcan, and we're doing. They normally would retail at 60, but we're offering them at 50 for three signed copies. Oh, sorry, signed copies of each of the books. So that's one thing. Actually, that's been quite popular. We've been offering that for a little while, and people have taken that up. But no, I mean, I suppose, you know, the boringly traditional thing to say is look at our website, and there'll be offers on there from time to time.
Yeah, and just give us the details of that then, John, just before we go, where we can find out about you online, the website, but also on social media as well.
Yep. Well, the website is www.grubstreet1b1word.co.uk, and we're tweeting at grub, then there's a hyphen. I never really understand these things, Pete. There's a hyphen and then street. I think your listeners will understand them.
Yeah, I'll put links to those in the show notes. And you ship all around the world, do you?
Yeah, we do. We've got coverage all around the world. I think we're even into Eastern Europe now. We've got rep traveling there. We're pretty strong in the States and Australia and New Zealand, Canada. We just set up. So yeah, people can buy our books wherever they are, Peter, I like to think.
Well, it's funny, in this age of technology, of tablets and iPhones, it's still the solid book that most of us like to have on our shelves. So, John, thanks very much for doing all the hard work and allowing us to get access to these wonderful books. And thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thanks, Peter. I appreciate your comments. And we do solidly support the physical book. We really do. And it's been a pleasure being with you. Thank you.
Now, for a chance to win a copy of Grub Street Publishing's latest book called An Alien Sky, a signed copy we have to give away, all you have to do is go to our Facebook page or to our Twitter page and write in the name of the book, An Alien Sky, hashtag Grub Street. And we will pick at random a winner for the signed copy of this book. It's a beautiful book, just under 200 pages long. As I said, it's a signed copy and it will go great on any aviation enthusiast's shelf. Andrew Wiseman, born in Poland, flew for the RAF, got shot down by a Luftwaffe night fighter, was captured and was taken into the camps, was a prisoner of war. This is quite a fabulous story. So it is something well worth winning. Just for the opportunity, go to our Facebook page or to our Twitter feed, put in the name of the book, An Alien Sky, hashtag Grub Street, and you've got a chance to win that book. Good luck.
Find this and other great shows at the Aviation Media Network.
TheVoicesInYourHead.com.
Then finally, just before we go, a few books on my bookshelf. I currently have Empire on the Clouds, which I'm about to read. Wings on My Sleeve, I have read, mentioned, of course, by Simon earlier. Fantastic book by Eric Winkle Brown. The Phantom in Focus, I'm halfway through. Fantastic book by Dave Gledhill. But one book I did want to mention, and this is a book called Skyfaring, and that's by Mark Van Hoenacker. Now, Mark is a British Airways pilot. He writes an absolutely fascinating account of flight from his perspective. It's extraordinarily written. The language is exquisite. It's very, very well written. He describes all elements of flight, the airline business, all about aircraft, but he does it in a way that's really, really fascinating and gripping. And I've seen many, many very positive write-ups of this book. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes. I would highly recommend it as a stunningly good read. So that's what I have on my bookshelf at the moment and what I'm reading. Okay, that's about it. That's all we have for you on this special book edition of Aviation Extended. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions. And of course, you can find Extended now on Stitcher.com and iTunes. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website, and please do ask before using anything you hear. The program is produced with a Creative Commons license. You can find me, of course, I'm Peter Johnson, at Nascot Hornet on Twitter and at xtpmedia.co.uk. Well, we hope you've enjoyed that special edition. With the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. And remember, stay tuned to this frequency, Extended, Europe's premier aerospace radio station.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme. Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
This is XTP Media.